Well, welcome to the physics continuing series of talks. This speaker is our last outside speaker for the semester. We do have one more talk next week. That's me. I'm talking about some fun stuff left over from the research I did on my book for the public. And it should be just a way of ending the semester with some pleasant ideas and nothing really in regards to actual research, but archive type. Our speaker today is Professor Dan Kaplan, who comes from us from the Illinois Institute of Technology, where he's on the faculty. He's actually on sabbatical at Berkeley, and he just happens to be flying from Berkeley back to Chicago via Wichita, so we diverted him for a short stay here to give a talk, which is an efficient way to get a speaker. Dan did his PhD work at Stony Brook, and was on and was mentored in a lot of ways by Leon Lederman in his PhD in his career in particle physics. And today he's going to be talking about muon cooling and muon colliders. Accelerators and accelerator research has been and improved accelerators has been the backbone of doing new physics, and it's becoming a very interesting engineering technology aspect of industry, who are starting to use more and more of accelerator technology in various aspects. So let's thank Dan for coming.
Thank you, Nick. Glad to be here. Let me eliminate the trip hazards. Having been OSHA trained, of course, for my work at Fermilab, then I have to figure out which end of the laser pointer is which. There it is.
Don't look down.
They hit the button. Okay, so as Nick mentioned, my topic is muon cooling and future muon facilities. And I put some fireworks here for a reason that you'll see later on. So, as usual with a play, you begin with a list of the cast of characters, or in Latin, dramatis personae. And then I'll talk about the physics that we can do with neutrino factories and muon colliders, the technical challenges, and then I'll talk about a few of the technical challenges in more detail. And then I will conclude. So first, the cast of characters. Matter and energy, right? Those are the cast of characters for a talk about particle physics. But we can be more specific. So we've been studying matter and energy now for many decades. And we've now learned exactly what everything is made of. So this lists all the particles in the standard model of particle physics. And actually, the elementary particles are not the proton and the neutron and so on, but they're the quarks out of which the proton and neutron are made, and the leptons that accompany those quarks. For example, if you want to make a proton, you make it by combining two up quarks with a down quark. So probably some of you remember the wacky electric charges that quarks have. The up quark has a charge of plus 2/3 E, and the down quark has a charge of minus 1/3 E. So if you add it up, you see the charge is conserved, right? 2/3 plus 2/3, that's 4/3, minus 1/3, that's 1. That's the charge of the proton, and so forth. So you can make an antiproton just by using antiquarks. Each of these particles also has an antiquark. So antimatter is made of antiquarks, matter is made of quarks. There are also these things called mesons that are intermediate, if you like, between matter and antimatter, because each meson has both a quark and an antiquark in it, so that some of the properties cancel. Leptons, on the other hand, really are elementary. They're not made of anything that we know of. And so you can combine these things to make a proton or neutron. The quarks are held together by exchanging gluons. That's this column here of the chart, the force carriers, the photon, the gluon, and the Z and W of the weak force. So gluons can be exchanged among quarks, and that's what holds them together inside a proton. And they can also be exchanged among protons and neutrons, which is what holds the nucleus together. So that's mathematically quite analogous to the way that the hydrogen atom is held together. You take one of these baryons that has three quarks in it. If it's a proton, it can be bound to an electron, in fact, by the exchange of virtual photons. Now, what about the W and the Z? They're not responsible for holding things together. They're responsible for why things fall apart. The neutron, for example, has an average lifetime of about 15 minutes. It's a little bit more massive than the proton, so it can decay into a proton by emitting an electron and an electron antineutrino. So we understand that reaction as being a d-quark inside the neutron, emitting a W boson, and that transmutes it into an up quark, right? Minus one-third. Is my arithmetic backwards? No, that's right. Minus one-third of an electric charge on this side. On this side, we have plus two-thirds minus one. So that's also minus one-third. And then the W minus, which is a virtual particle in this decay, can materialize as an electron antineutrino pair. So that's a summary of the dramatis personae in the standard model of particle physics. Of course, there are lots of unsolved problems. I'm going to focus on two of them in this talk. The standard model is certainly incomplete and doesn't tell us everything that we would like to know about the universe. For example, one unsolved problem in the standard model is why there's actually matter in the universe. Now, we know that there's matter in the universe because we're made of it. But what we observe when we study in experiments the conversion of matter to energy is that whenever you convert energy into matter, you get equal amounts of matter and antimatter. And if you want to convert matter into energy, it has to annihilate with an equal amount of antimatter. So it's this equal that's the problem. Because the Big Bang was a massive conversion of energy into matter. It must have produced equal amounts of matter and antimatter based on what we know about particle physics. But then if you think about what would have happened after the Big Bang, the universe would expand and cool, and there would be the opportunity for every particle of matter to encounter a particle of antimatter and annihilate. So that would leave a universe of only energy, which would be much more boring than what we actually observe. So we can infer from the fact that we're here that somehow, after the Big Bang, a slight excess of matter developed. How it happened, we don't know. So that's the big question. But what we observe when we look out in the universe and count things is roughly 10 billion photons per baryon. So evidently, we started out with 10 billion antibaryons and 10 billion and one baryons. And then after the great annihilation, what was left was that one leftover baryon. So how did this one part in 10 billion asymmetry between matter and antimatter in the early universe come about? That's one of the big unsolved problems. We really didn't have much of a clue until the 70s when Andrei Sakharov did a very interesting piece of work. And he realized that there are three conditions that are both necessary and sufficient for a matter-antimatter symmetric universe to evolve into one with a small matter excess. One condition is you need to have C and CP violation, which is a technical term meaning that matter and antimatter have to be unambiguously not identical mirror images. There has to be a slight distinguishing characteristic of matter. You also obviously need to have non-conservation of baryon number. You need to be able to destroy an antibaryon without at the same time destroying a baryon. And you have to have non-equilibrium conditions, because in equilibrium, these processes would go both ways. So you wouldn't get a net excess of matter over antimatter if the universe were in equilibrium. But obviously, after the Big Bang, there was a long period when the universe was out of equilibrium. So these three conditions are quite plausible, as it turns out. In fact, we have evidence for C and CP violation. We don't have evidence for non-conservation of baryon number, but theorists say, in fact, there are obscure mechanisms in the standard model that can give rise to that.
But we never saw
one. We've never seen it. It only happens at very high energy. I actually asked Tom Kibble about this. I said, is there a way of explaining this in simple language? And he thought about it a bit and he said, no, there isn't. So I'm not going to try to explain it. It's complicated. But what Sakharov showed was that during any period where these three conditions are satisfied, whatever net baryon number may have been in existence beforehand is destroyed. In other words, you might say it's simple. Especially in Kansas, you might say it's simple. God said, let there be matter, and there was matter. End of story, right? But Sakharov says, not so fast. Because these mechanisms would have destroyed the primordial baryon number of the universe. So God had to do something more complicated. But these mechanisms would also create a small net baryon number. So this is called baryogenesis, how baryons were created in the early universe in excess of antibaryons. So that's one problem I want to talk about. And the other problem with the standard model is that if we look at the masses of all these elementary particles, there's an enormous range in mass, ranging from the top part way up here at about 200 GeV, billion electron volts equivalent, to the neutrinos, which for which the upper limit is 2 electron volts in mass. The actual mass of a neutrino has yet to be measured, but there are upper limits from experiment. So that's a range of at least 11 orders of magnitude. And it's a very strange pattern, begging, crying out for explanation. In the standard model, this is supposed to come about from the coupling of these various particles to the Higgs field. But of course, the Higgs has not been discovered yet. On the other hand, the experimentalists at the LHC at CERN think they're closing in on it, and this year they're going to get enough data actually to discover it, if they're lucky, right? There are hints that it's there and that it's being seen. Maybe it's just a statistical fluke and they're not going to find it. But more likely, the hints are correct and real and will be confirmed in the data that they're about to start taking. Are they running now or are they just turning on now? I forget. Anyway, in 2012, there's going to be a long run in which they will accumulate a lot more data than they've taken up until now. Of course, just finding the Higgs doesn't answer the question. It says that, yes, the Higgs mechanism is there, but it doesn't explain this 11 orders of magnitude. And a lot of theorists think that, in fact, it's not the standard model Higgs. It'll be something more complicated involving so-called supersymmetry. And it could be tricky. So this is an area where it could be very valuable to have a muon collider. And I'll say more about that when we get there. By the way, stop me if you have questions. It's a lot more interesting if we have a conversation than if I just do all the talking. Okay, so where have we gotten to in our outline? We've introduced the dramatis personae, and now we'll talk about neutrino factories and muon colliders. So here are some sketches of a neutrino factory and a muon collider. And if you look at it closely, you'll see they have a lot in common. In particular, this piece here is almost identical for both facilities. So to build either one of these, you need a megawatt scale proton beam, very intense proton beam, more intense by an order of magnitude than any proton beam that now exists on the Earth. Then you need a target that you can strike with that beam without the target getting totally destroyed. And then those reactions of protons in the target will produce lots and lots of pi mesons. The pi meson is unstable and decays into a muon and a neutrino. So you can produce a very large flux of neutrinos, of muons this way. And then you need to manipulate the muon beam to get it ready for acceleration. So that's what this buncher and cooler are. And then you go into acceleration to get the muon beam up to the desired energy, and then you put the muons into a storage ring. If it's a neutrino factory, the storage ring should have long straight sides that aim muons, that aim neutrinos produced in muon decay at a remote detector. Or if it's a muon collider you want, then you make a circular ring in which the muons go around and around in opposite directions positive muons one way, negative muons the other way, and they collide as many times as possible before they decay. So you could imagine, actually, that the muon collider would be a very logical upgrade of a neutrino factory. So it might make sense to build first a neutrino factory, which is a billion-dollar scale investment, and then upgrade it into a muon collider later. In fact, Fermilab has a kind of a sketch of a plan for the future of the laboratory. And it's on the web, and you can find it. And then if you click on the link, you see what happens. So this is the existing complex at Fermilab. The LINAC and the booster accelerator and the main injector and the Tevatron and then the external beam lights. And if we click on the button, you see the grand future plan in which various neutrino beams are produced and you have a muon accelerator and you have Project X and you have muon anti-muon collisions and so on. So we can zoom in on that and see the stages. The first piece of the plan is to build this megawatt-class proton accelerator. It's called Project X, probably not a very good name, especially since there's now a movie by that name. I guess about a wild party, is that what it is? So we don't want Congress thinking we're going to use $1 billion to have a good wild party. I'm sure they'll come up with a better name than Project X. Anyway, that's a very high-power LINAC, linear accelerator, that can do low-energy, high-intensity experiments. And then you can use it to upgrade the rest of the complex at Fermilab. So you can take the protons, put them into the main injector and recycler, and use that to make a muon beam. For example, the long baseline neutrino experiment that's now being discussed, in which the beam would be sent to South Dakota and detected in the Homestake gold mine. Then beyond that, you could make muons and you could cool them and have a muon storage ring for a neutrino factory. And then you could build additional stages of acceleration and a collision ring, and then you'd have a muon collider. So that's the grand vision for the future of Fermilab. Something that might take place over the next 20 years, let's say.
Does that require the Tevatron coming back?
No. No, the Tevatron tunnel is a useful thing. You would build a new accelerator inside the Tevatron tunnel. I'll come to that. Okay, so let me say a bit more about why neutrino factories could be important. Who knows what's the most fundamental particle physics discovery of the past decade or so? I have my opinion, of course, but...
Neutrino mass.
Neutrino mass, good. Equivalently, you can say it as neutrino mixing. Neutrino mixing proves that neutrinos have mass. And it also proves that they mix. The discovery plot, so to speak, was this plot from the Supercamiokande experiment, where they compared muons produced in the upper atmosphere and coming down from above to muons produced in the atmosphere on the other side of the world and coming up from below. And the ones coming down from above agreed with what they expected, but the ones coming up from below were depleted by about a factor of 2. And we now know that that's because they were oscillating as they passed through the Earth into a different kind of neutrino to which the Supercamiokande detector was not sensitive. So it's now been confirmed by several other experiments, and we know that that's really what's going on. And in fact, it presents possibly the best explanation for baryogenesis. Baryogenesis, according to Sakharov, requires CP violation. If neutrino mixing violates CP, which is certainly possible, then there are papers that show that it could be a strong enough effect to account for the baryon asymmetry of the universe. So this version of baryogenesis is actually known as leptogenesis because the CP violation is in the lepton set. Theorists, of course, are very imaginative. It's even been proposed that neutrino mixing could have something to do with dark energy. I don't know whether this is taken seriously by most people, but it's not a priori out of the question. So neutrino mixing is a really interesting thing, and we really need to know more about it. So what are the key physics questions, then, in neutrino mixing. What is the neutrino mass hierarchy? That's the simplest question. We know, of course, what the mass hierarchy of the charged leptons is. The tau is the heaviest, the muon is lighter, and the electron is the lightest. So that's what we would call a natural hierarchy. If the tau-like neutrino is the heaviest neutrino, and the electron-like neutrino is the lightest one. But all experimental data are actually equally consistent with an inverted hierarchy, in which the electron and muon-like neutrinos are heavier, and the tau neutrino is lighter. So it's very interesting to figure out which world we live in. It has impact on the other experimental measurements, and it even has astrophysics impact. But then what about the neutrino mixing matrix? When you have three things that mix in particle physics, we already have a mathematical formulism to deal with that, because the quarks behave that way also. We account for it in terms of an SU3 rotation matrix, or a mixing matrix, and it's a 3x3 matrix. And in the case of quarks, it goes by the name Kibibo Kobayashi Moskawa, because they were the people who worked through the math of quark mixing. There are three angles. There's the mixing angle between the first two quarks, first two generations, the second and third generations, and the first and third generations. And for quarks, it's very hierarchical. The first one is big, the second one is small, and the third one is tiny. The neutrino mixing matrix, of course, generically speaking, it's a 3x3 matrix, so it looks like the CKM matrix. But the PMNS matrix, Pontecorvo-Maki-Nagawa-Sakata matrix, I think I said that right, doesn't look in detail anything like the CKM matrix. Two of the angles are big. In fact, theta 2-3 seems to be maximum. 45 degrees is as big as a mixing angle can get. Whereas the third angle is quite small, and until recently, no one had succeeded in measuring it. Three experiments, Dia Bay, Reno, and Double Show, have just come out with their first results that establish that, in fact, it's about 9 degrees. So this pattern of angles is completely different from that pattern of angles. Then there's the question, what about delta? When you have a 3x3 SU3 rotation matrix, it doesn't have to be real. It can have a phase that makes it complex. And if it's complex, then the mixing phenomenon violates CP. So we really want to know, how big is delta? Does neutrino mixing violate CP? And then finally, you can ask the big question, which is the hardest question of all, which is this whole formalism everything that's going on, or is there something more subtle or more complicated going on? So this set of questions motivates measuring the elements of the PMNS matrix as precisely as possible. And a lot of work has gone into the question, how can you do that? And at the moment, there are three techniques that have been studied. The first is the conventional approach, the so-called superbeam. There are already experiments like Minos and NOVA, which is under construction, and T2K, which is in operation, in which you make a muon neutrino beam at an accelerator lab and aim it hundreds of kilometers away at a detector. So to make a super beam, you just have to scale up the beam power and scale up the size of the detector. So T2K, they're hoping there'll be a 3 megawatt proton upgrade, NOVA with Project X, and then Hyper-K, LBNE, the long baseline neutrino experiment in the US, and maybe an experiment at CERN to the Fréjus tunnel. Another technique that's more ambitious technically is a so-called beta beam, in which you build a storage ring and you fill it with an isotope that beta decays. You use that as a source of neutrinos and antineutrinos. People tell me that this is getting to look very unlikely, especially because we now know that theta 1-3 is relatively big. 9 degrees is pretty big. And then the third one is the neutrino factory, which I've already talked about. And I'll say more about it in a bit. So, for example, there have been a number of studies that compare the reach of these various techniques. So you want to know, what's the reach in CP violation, what's the reach for the mass hierarchy, and what's the reach for the small mixing angle theta 1-3? And these studies were done over the last few years when theta 1-3 had not yet been measured. The largest it could be was about 10 degrees based on a previous experiment, the Shaw experiment in France. So people studied the reach of these techniques on a range from 10 to the minus 1 down to 10 to the minus 5. And what they consistently found was that the neutrino factory has the greatest reach of any of the techniques I've mentioned. So even if you can start, let's say, with a superbeam, eventually we're going to want the neutrino factory to measure the matrix elements with precision and see whether something else might also be happening in neutrino mixing. So, as I say, there's been a lot of work. I won't talk about it in detail, but here are various reports if you're interested. And what they've established is that a neutrino factory is feasible using existing technology, and that it costs of order $1 billion, given that you already have the high-power proton source. Of course, it's more expensive if you need high-energy neutrinos. It's less expensive if you need low-energy neutrinos. Okay, now what about the physics case for muon colliders? A lot of work, of course, has been done on electron-positron colliders. And the trouble with electron-positron colliders is that as you go to high energies, if you put the electrons and the positrons in a storage ring, they radiate at a very high rate. So the large electron-positron ring at CERN, the LEP ring, is roughly the largest electron-positron ring that you can imagine building. And it was radiating megawatts, I believe, at their final energy. It might even have been tens of megawatts. So the whole trick was to feed in radio frequency accelerating power as fast as you can to keep the electrons and positrons at the required energy. So to go beyond that, people talk about a linear electron-positron collider. Of course, a linear electron-positron collider is a very big, expensive thing. In contrast, the muon, of course, is 200 times as massive as the electron. Radiation goes as the square of the mass, or is it the cube? It's a large power. So that's an enormous factor, and it means that a muon collider can be circular. So this diagram compares the sizes of various proposed accelerators to the Brookhaven National Laboratory and Fermilab sites. And you see that most of these proposed accelerators are a lot bigger than Brookhaven or Fermilab. Even the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, which is, I think, 17 miles in circumference. Here was the proposed next linear collider. Here was the proposed Very Large Hadron Collider, which would reach out to Rockford, Illinois, if you built it at Fermilab. On the other hand, here are some muon colliders. Even a 3 TeV muon collider, which is competitive with the LHC at CERN, would fit on the Fermilab or Brookhaven site. And the fact that they're so small suggests that it's probably very cost-effective compared to building a linear collider. But we haven't done a cost estimate yet. That's one of the things that we're working towards. Now, what about the physics? The Higgs, of course, is supposed to be responsible for particles having mass. So you won't be surprised that if you want to make the Higgs by colliding lepton pairs, the cross-section goes as the square of the lepton mass. So it's 40,000 times bigger for muons than it is for electrons. So a muon collider is a fabulous thing for studying the Higgs. In fact, if the Higgs is supersymmetric, you have this situation where there's more than one of them and they're closely spaced. So the spacing is determined by this beta parameter in supersymmetry. If the tangent of beta is 5, you have one Higgs at, let's say, 350 JeV and another one 2 JeV higher. That's not an easy thing to untangle, especially if you're talking about an electron-positron collider. But there's no reason that beta couldn't be even larger. For tan beta of 10, you see that they're within less than a JeV of each other. There's no way that an electron-positron collider could resolve this line shape. But a muon collider can. And the reason is because of radiative effects when the electrons and positrons approach each other. It spreads out the beam energy in the collision. The black curve here is the beam energy distribution for CLIC, the so-called compact linear collider that's being studied at CERN. And the red is the beam collision energy distribution for a muon collider. So a muon collider really is a precision tool for studying supersymmetric Higgs particles. Okay, so I've laid out the physics case for each of these new types of facility. Now, we know neutrinos mix, right? So the physics case for a neutrino factory is already established. especially given that we now know the size of theta 1-3, which we didn't know until this year. So we can now say, you are here, right? These studies comparing the various neutrino facilities cover this enormous range in sine squared theta 1-3. Now what we need to do is to study facilities that are optimized for 9 degrees. And what it means is, if you want to build a neutrino factory, you don't need a 20-jev neutrino factory. A 4-jev neutrino factory probably does the physics, and it's a lot cheaper. On the other hand, it also means that the superbeams get much more attractive. So we're not going to be able to convince the neutrino community to spend $1 billion on a neutrino factory anytime soon. They're going to want to do LBNE first. What about the physics case for a muon collider? Well, we haven't yet discovered the Higgs. We haven't yet discovered supersymmetry or whatever other new physics might justify the construction of a muon collider and the choice of its energy. But we hope that the LHC is about to make a breakthrough. In a year, we'll know a lot more. Gee, I'm only on the third item of my... Well, I'm halfway through. This will work. So what are the technical challenges and how do we meet them? What are the hard parts, in other words, of a neutrino factory or a muon collider? One of them is the high-power proton beam in the target. Another one is cooling the muon beam, about which I'll say quite a bit more. Another one is accelerating the muons before they decay. And finally, building a storage ring with a very high bending field. Because you want to get the most collisions you can before the muons decay. And that means bending them in the smallest possible radius. Well, the high-power proton beam designs exist. For example, the Project X superconducting LINAC proposed by Fermilab. What about a target? Nowadays, people use solid targets for this kind of thing. But it's pretty clear that if you scale the beam power up by an order of magnitude, the target will not last very long. So a natural engineering choice would be to use a liquid target, for example, mercury. In fact, mercury is the choice that was made for the 2 megawatt beam at the spallation neutron source of Oak Ridge. They run into engineering problems because they have it in the container, and the violent reactions in the mercury tend to make holes in the container. So that leads us to the idea of a free mercury jet. And this was tested in an experiment at CERN, the Mercury Intense Target Experiment, or MERIT, which our R&D program proposed and carried out a few years ago. So it involved a big syringe, right? You fill the syringe with mercury, and then you pump on the handle, and the mercury gets injected through a pipe, and then it makes a jet coming back this way. And at the same time, you hit it with a proton beam from CERN. I don't have time to go into the details, but it did verify the concept, and it says that it's workable, certainly at 4 megawatts and probably at 8 megawatts. So how do you cool a beam of muons? For a muon collider, you want a luminosity in the range of 10 to the 34 collisions per square centimeter of cross-section per second, because you're trying to study rare processes. And, for example, two designs have been thought about. One is called a high-emittance muon collider, another a low-emittance muon collider. The low-emittance collider gets a factor of 3 more luminosity for the same 4-megawatt proton beam on target. And you see the big difference is the size of the beam. So the so-called transverse emittance. So in one case, we have a muon beam with a 25 micron transverse size. And in the other case, the more ambitious case, we have to make the beam an order of magnitude smaller. The smaller you make the beam, the more likely it is that the muon and the anti-muon will hit each other when they cross. It's a simple idea. Now, on the other hand, if all you want to build is a neutrino factory, you don't need the beam to be anywhere near as small. It can be 300 times bigger. So you need 300 times more cooling for a muon collider than for a neutrino factory. That's another reason why a neutrino factory makes sense as an intermediate stage. Because you don't have to tackle the entire technical challenge of cooling the muon beam by this big factor. So, to understand what this means, it's useful to plot the history of the bunch of muons along an axis of transverse emittance and longitudinal emittance. How wide the beam is, or narrow, and how long the beam bunch is. So any particular design is going to be some path from an initial emittance when the muons are produced to a final emittance when they collide. And at each step, you need to use a different kind of technology. But also, to get to the needed final emittance, you need to cool the initial beam both in the transverse dimensions and in the longitudinal dimensions. So it's a hard problem. Whereas for a neutrino factory, transverse cooling is enough. So let me then spend a few more slides on muon cooling. Cooling in general, if you don't want to be confused, you have to think carefully about what cooling means. And it's best understood in terms of the normalized emittance of the beam. Emittance just means the volume in phase space. So it's not just the size in x and y, it's also the size in x divergence and y divergence. If you focus a beam, you can always make it smaller. But when you do that, you increase the divergence. So the thing that's the invariant in phase space is the beam size in the entire six-dimensional space, in which you take into account not only the geometrical size of the beam, but also the size in momentum space. So that's what we mean by emittance. And then Liouville tells us something very important, which is a conservative Hamiltonian, such as, for example, magnetic fields in an accelerator or beamline, leaves the emittance as a constant. So you can't actually cool a beam with DC magnetic fields, or even with AC magnetic fields. But there's a detail here that matters, which is if you accelerate the beam, it actually shrinks, because the divergence gets smaller, right? A higher energy beam going through the same magnet doesn't bend as much. So that's not cooling. Cooling is something that you do over and above what you get from magnetic focusing. So cooling is the reduction of normalized emittance. We take the geometrical beam size and we multiply it by momentum, so that if we accelerate the beam, the normalized emittance stays the same. If we can shrink the beam without accelerating it, that's cooling. So we have to do it in some method that's very, very fast and that evades Liouville's theorem. So it needs to be a non-Hamiltonian situation. In other words, for example, you have to violate energy conservation. Well, how do you do that? The established methods involve slow manipulations of the beam. They take seconds to hours, whereas the muon only lives for 2 microseconds. So how can you cool a beam that quickly? There's one solution. It's called ionization cooling. And it's very simple, actually. You just allow the muons to lose energy and material. That slows them down. It reduces the momentum without affecting to first order the beam size. And then if you accelerate the beam, it shrinks. So that's ionization cooling in a nutshell. So we can sketch it as a series of absorbers in which muons lose energy, interspersed with radio frequency cavities that replace the lost energy, but accelerate only along the beam direction. So as you do that over and over again, the divergence of the beam shrinks.
Just to point out that some people maybe don't understand, the higher angle you go, you got more ionization cooling because you increase the path length.
That's also true, but that's a minor effect in the channels that we're discussing. There are two effects when you go through an absorber. One of them is ionization energy loss, which has this kind of a dependence on material and on momentum. So at low momentum, it's very high. At high momentum, it gets smaller. And then as you go to still higher momentum, it grows gradually. So there's an ionization minimum around a momentum of beta gamma equals 2. Also, hydrogen is a much more powerful ionization energy loss material than other materials. Now, as you lose energy by ionization, that reduces the emittance, but at the same time, there's some probability for a muon to pass close to a nucleus and get scattered by a large angle, and that increases the emittance. So the net effect can be expressed by an equation like this, that the change of normalized emittance with path length decreases because of ionization and increases because of multiple scattering. And so you want to find a working point and a material that optimize this. And it turns out the optimum is around the ionization minimum. And the best material is liquid hydrogen because it has the largest ratio. It has the largest factor of dE/dx times radiation length. The most ionization per unit of multiple scattering. And this beta parameter that multiplies the heating term is the focal length of the magnetic focusing system. So you also want to focus very strongly at the location of the absorber. If the beam is strongly convergent, then the small angular changes from nuclear scattering will be less important. And this is the only solution, at least at low energies. Now, it's inherently transverse, right? It reduces only the beam divergence. And yet we said that we also need to cool longitudinally. We do that with a trick, which I will get to. These concepts are subtle enough. You know, on paper it's very simple, but in practice it's not so easy. So we decided we needed an experiment to demonstrate it. That's the muon ionization cooling experiment. It's under construction at Rutherford Appleton Laboratory in England. And this is what it looks like. We measure each muon precisely as it comes in, then it goes through one ionization cooling cell, and then we measure it again as it goes out. And it would be nice to build a longer cooling cell and see a bigger effect, but that would cost a lot of money. So instead we're talking about making very precise measurements of muon emittance so that we see a 10% effect and we measure it to about 1%. of itself. And the goal here isn't just to say, yes, it works. It's to say, in detail, our simulations are reliable. So that if we design a different kind of ionization cooling channel, we can still be confident that it will work in a predictable way. I don't really have time to go through it in detail, but the magnetic field as the muon, that the muon sees goes from plus 4 tesla in one spectrometer through these wiggles that focus the beam. Then there's a field flip, and then minus 4 tesla at the other spectrometer. This gives us a lot of flexibility. We don't have to flip the field. So if we choose to run all the magnetic fields in the same direction, that's a different optics configuration. That's another test of the Monte Carlo simulation. So it's really a test bed for understanding ionization cooling experimentally in detail in as many different configurations as we can come up with. And what you see is the normalized transverse emittance decreases in each absorber. And it's reduced by about 10%. And of course the RF cavities in between replace the lost energy. It's a fairly big undertaking. It's kind of a $50 million experiment. And no one region of the world had the resources to pay for the whole thing, so it's being done by an international collaboration. To give you a quick tour, this is what Rutherford Appleton Laboratory looks like from the air. It's in Oxfordshire, which is a nice part of the world. And the most obvious thing at Rutherford Lab is the Diamond Synchrotron Radiation Machine, which is new. But they also have this spallation neutron source called ISIS, which is a 50 hertz synchrotron. Produces lots and lots of neutrons. So we're parasitic on ISIS. Here's part of the ISIS beam line behind their shield wall. We dip a little piece of metal into the halo of the beam about once per second, which produces pions, which are captured and focused and bent. They decay inside this solenoid. The muons then are bent and focused and enter the MICE apparatus. The beam line is assembled and working. Here are various pieces of it.
Actually, the beamline, the downstream beamline is straight. It only looks like it's bent because the photographer used a fisheye lens to get it all into one picture.
And the various pieces of the cooling cell and spectrometers are under construction. The spectrometer solenoids are still at the vendor in Livermore, California. Right now, we're pumping down on it to get all the water vapor out of the insulation, and pretty soon we'll be cooling it and turning it on and seeing how well it works. The precision muon tracking detectors are set up at Rutherford Lab for a cosmic ray test. These RF cavities, of course, require big power supplies, which are being refurbished at Darisbury Lab. We got them surplus. This would have been a $100 million experiment if we didn't use a lot of surplus equipment. And, of course, we have the liquid hydrogen absorbers, which are built in Japan, and the RF cavities, which are built in the U.S. So the schedule, we've done step one. Step one is build the beamline, install the muon particle ID detectors, and see how well it works. We're now gearing up for step four. That should happen later this year when the spectrometer solenoids are delivered to England. And then comes step five and six when the cooling cell is finished. We hope in 2016. So that's mice. Now, we said we need very strong focusing at the absorber. That implies that the radio frequency accelerating cavities have to operate in a high magnetic field. And that's not something that people have done before. And we've been trying to figure out how to make it work. It's not so easy. We built a test area at Fermilab, the MuCool test area, in which we have a 5 Tesla solenoid with a hole in it where we can insert an 805 megahertz RF cavity and detectors, and we can also put a beam in it because this is built out by the end of the linear accelerator at Fermilab. And what we've discovered, and it's been occupying us now for a few years, is that RF cavities don't seem to work as well when you put them in a strong magnetic field. So here's one of our 805 megahertz cavities. At zero Tesla, we were able to operate it at 40 megavolts per meter. Whereas at 4 Tesla, it lost about two-thirds of its accelerating gradient because it broke down if you tried to raise the gradient too high. You got sparks. And the sparks tend to damage the surface, and then the cavity doesn't work as well. So we're now working on solutions. Can you build very, very smooth surfaces that won't break down, or very clean surfaces, or surfaces with special coatings? Or can you fill the cavities with hydrogen instead of operating them in vacuum? Well, we've tried that and it works. Muons Incorporated is a small business that was founded to do SBIR-funded muon cooling R&D. And they've shown that as you raise the density of the hydrogen by pressurizing it more and more, you can operate at higher and higher accelerating gradients. And putting it in a magnetic field doesn't affect the performance. The big question here is, if you put a very intense bunch of muons through, that'll ionize some of the hydrogen, and the electrons will load down the cavity. So can you operate the cavity in that situation? And that's what they're working on right now. So this is a work in progress. We hope in a year or two that we will have identified the solutions to operating these cavities in the necessary magnetic fields. What about six-dimensional cooling? I've explained to you that ionization cooling is inherently four-dimensional. It cools the transverse degrees of freedom. Now, you could imagine trying to work up here where the slope of the dDx curve changes sign. But if you analyze it in detail, the negative feedback is not strong enough. So you cannot actually cool longitudinally in any direct way. But you can do it indirectly using something called emittance exchange. You need to couple the transverse and longitudinal degrees of freedom so that you convert longitudinal emittance, which you can't cool, into transverse emittance, which you can cool. And it's simple conceptually, right? Suppose you have a muon beam with some energy spread. That's longitudinal emittance. You put it through a bending magnet, and that introduces dispersion so that you get the low momentum muons on the inside and the high momentum muons on the outside. And then you put it through a wedge absorber to take out the energy spread. You don't even need the wedge absorber because inside the bending magnet, the high momentum muons have a longer path length. So you can just fill your magnet with high pressure hydrogen. So what you're doing is you're cooling the transverse emittance
exchanging transverse and longitudinal impedances, and thereby getting effectively six-dimensional cooling. It's tricky in practice. To get the dispersion, you typically want the helical kind of beam motion. And three different kinds of helices have been studied. They all seem to work. Which one you should choose for what part of the cooling system remains to be worked through. So I don't want to say more about that right now. A lot of people are working on it, and in a few years we should be able to say something more. In particular, the results I already showed you were obtained with this so-called Guggenheim helical cooling channel. So the front end cools only transversely. This is not cooling. This is just splitting the beam up into small pieces so that each piece has a smaller longitudinal impedance. Then we cool transversely in a linear cooling channel. Then we can get six-dimensional cooling using a series of these Guggenheim cooling channels. At some point, you reach the smallest emittance that's practical in a scheme like this. And then you can do reverse emittance exchange, in which you let the transverse emittance continue to decrease at the expense of longitudinal emittance to get down to the final emittance that you need for a muon collider. And to do that effectively, you need very high magnetic fields, like 40 or 50 tesla. It doesn't seem impossible, but there's a lot of engineering work required to demonstrate a 40 tesla muon cooling channel. The basic principle of six-dimensional cooling can be tested using wedge absorbers in mice, and we're in the process of getting those absorbers built. To get to the final emittances, as I've already mentioned, requires final cooling of one scheme or another, and this is work I don't have time to go into in detail unless somebody has a question later on. So what about muon acceleration? The thing about it is you need to do it fast, right? So the fastest way to accelerate anything is with a LINAC. You start with a LINAC, then where you get to a high enough momentum to recirculate the muons, you can have an RLA in which the muons go back and forth several times so that you can reuse the RF cavities for greater economy. In this scheme, there are two different recirculating linear accelerators that get you up to 12.5 GeV of muon energy. And then you can go into a fixed field alternating gradient accelerator. For a muon collider, this can get you up to about 25 GeV. For a muon collider, you might want 750 GeV. 750 on 750 would be 1.5 TeV of collision energy. There's a cute scheme that does that using the Tevatron tunnel, but filling it with new, very strong magnets. And the idea is you have superconducting magnets that operate at a fixed field, and normal conducting magnets that you can ramp very quickly from a negative field to a plus field. So that you start with, at low energy, a lattice that has in-bends and out-bends, kind of like an FFAG, and then at high energy, it's all in-bends. And so as I mentioned, as you go from pure LINAC through FFAG to rapid cyclic synchrotron, you're getting more and more cost effective. This FFAG, or hybrid rapid cyclic synchrotron, has the nice idea that you can combine in-bends with out-bends and so get a very large momentum range in a single machine. And it was novel enough that my colleagues decided they needed to build a demonstration experiment, the EMMA experiment at Darisbury Lab. It's built and working. The concept does work, and there are detailed questions that are now being worked through. This has interesting spin-off. You could use it for very high intensity proton machines, for muon accelerators, for cancer therapy, and maybe even for subcritical fission reactors, accelerator-driven fission reactors. The muon storage ring is also a technical challenge. Here's one design that was worked out by Alexa Hinn's team at Fermilab. The goal was to have a focusing strip focal length of 1 centimeter, and they achieved that. This is where the collisions happen. That's why I had the firecrackers. So that woke up anybody who might have dozed off. It's important to have an explosion in every physics lecture, isn't it? In fact, I have a story about that. I'll try to tell it very briefly.
about Professor Partridge at Haverford College, who taught astronomy. And at one point, he was talking about the millisecond pulsars. And momentarily, he turned his back on the class, and there was an explosion. And he turned around and he said, "That was a millisecond." So this design achieves the 1 centimeter focal length that you need to get to this 10 to the 34 luminosity. There's an interesting problem, which is that as the muons go around the storage ring, they're constantly decaying. So you're bombarding the inner surface with electrons, and that heats them. So if it's superconducting magnets, which you need for a 10 Tesla bending field, then you need to put in tungsten or something to absorb all that heat so that you don't quench the magnets. But there's a clever alternative, which is to have open mid-plane magnets so that the decay electrons simply sweep through and don't touch the superconductor. So to conclude, let me tell you about the organization of this effort that's evolved. It's called the Muon Accelerator Program. As you see, it's multi-pronged. There are lots of problems that we have to work through and solve. Here's our website. We've gotten the Department of Energy to agree to support it based on a 7-year timescale for a feasibility study for a muon collider. And here's the organization. Mark Palmer is the program director. I'm one of the level one managers. To do this in 7 years, we're going to need $15 or $20 million a year. At the moment, we're at the $12 million a year level. So as the budget grows, we're going to have to get more people involved to get the work done in the time. And we have a couple of meetings a year. Most recently, we had a meeting last month at Slack, and the proceedings, the transparencies are on the web if somebody's curious. So to conclude, I've argued that a neutrino factory capable of producing 10 to the 21 neutrinos per year is feasible, and that it will provide the world's best measurements of the parameters of neutrino oscillation. A high luminosity muon collider looks like it's probably feasible. This reminds me of how you know if an algorithm is computable. The strict test of computability is if you can build a Turing machine that can execute the algorithm. But there's also an informal test of computability, which is you ask a programmer. And if he says it's computable, then he's right. So in that sense, a muon collider is most likely feasible. We've worked on it for a while. We don't see any showstoppers. But there is R&D that we need to do to prove that it's feasible. Whether you build a muon collider first and then a neutrino factory or the other way around is an open question right now. One of the technologies we need are these high-field, high-temperature superconductor magnets. And selection of the optimal technology, demonstration of its feasibility, and a first cost estimate are the main goals of this MAP 7-year program. So if you're interested, this would be a good time to join MAP. Thank you.
Right on time. Questions, discussions, ideas? I actually have one to start off. Muon collider, of course, is a higher energy way to search for new physics. And how would you say that you're going to be competing with the ability of a very large cosmic ray experiment that's going to both do astrophysics as well as use the upper energy, super high energy collisions to do unique physics discoveries as well?
Well, that's an interesting thing. The conventional wisdom is that you can't do precision studies with cosmic rays. You can discover things with cosmic rays that can later be studied with precision at accelerators. I was entering graduate school in 1974 when the Chart Park was in the midst of being discovered, as you know, simultaneously at Brookhaven and at Stanford. And my thesis experiment discovered the bottom quark. And I was quite shocked. You know, during the experiment, I had my nose in the circuitry, and I was understanding the electronics and doing the programming and so on. And then it came time to write my thesis, and I went to the library. And I was shocked to find that the fifth quark had already been predicted. These guys, Kobayashi and Moskawa in Japan, had realized that you needed 6 quarks in order to accommodate CP violation. And 20 years later, I organized a symposium at IIT on the history of the bottom quark. And Kobayashi came over and he explained to us why they were able to make that leap of discovery before even the discovery of the charm court, because they did their work in 1973. Etsuko Niu had a cosmic ray group at Nagoya, and he had flown emulsions in airplanes and saw some, I think he saw one event, which was consistent with a lifetime of 1.5 picoseconds. A particle was produced and decayed 1.5 picoseconds later. And on the basis of that event, he was convinced that there had to be a fourth quark. Nobody in the world believed him, except for these theorists at Nagoya. So Kobayashi said, at Nagoya, we knew about the charm quark in 1973. So it was logical to think that maybe there were a fifth and sixth quark. So this is, of course, just conventional wisdom. You can discover things in cosmic rays, but for real precision questions like what's the mass of the Higgs and are there two of them or just one, I don't think cosmic rays is going to answer a question like that. You can prove me wrong, of course.
Well, I mean, the part of the Auger North and the super large cosmic ray experiments and the next big conference for that will be at the University of Chicago in the end of September to follow up on the CERN meeting. And it has two thrusts. One thrust is this astrophysics, and the other thrust is that it's going to be hard to build a future, to keep building future accelerators bigger and bigger, and we're going to have to learn how to do particle physics experiments with the ultimate highest energy accelerator, that being the universe.
Yeah. Leon used to say the Big Bang was an accelerator lab with an infinite budget.
Other questions, discussions? Ideas. Holger.
Minor detail. When you said that beta beams are now probably not feasible, you meant...
No, I'm not saying not feasible. I'm just saying they're a lot of trouble, and they probably won't happen for that reason.
You mentioned now that theta 1-3 is large. I don't see what that has...
Yeah, that's sort of counterintuitive. Now, if theta 1-3 were zero, a beta beam would be useless. If theta 1-3 is 10 to the minus 5, a beta beam is not very useful, whereas a neutrino factory still is. So you might think that if theta 1-3 is even larger, then these experiments become even more interesting. The trouble is that the neutrino community is always focused on the next machine and not the one after that, because that's where you make your living, right? It's the next machine that you can build, get money for, do studies of, and publish. If theta 1-3 were small, the next machine would have no shot at CP violation. And so you could try to convince people to work on a neutrino factory or a beta beam. But now that theta 1-3 is big, the next experiment is the super beam. And it can do CP violation, and so everybody is going to want to do that first.
Okay, yeah, I see.
It's an aspect of sociology and not science.
Yes.
That's right.
Other questions, discussions? And of course, our students are invited to come and talk with Professor Kaplan in the Society of Physics Students Room if they want after this discussion. And you can talk privately without your professors being around. The theory being that then you don't feel bad asking questions that you don't want your professors to hear. But don't worry, your professors are going to take them out to dinner so we can ask questions we don't want the students to know about. Oh, another question, okay.
I guess it's mostly a political question. What do you think the funding possibilities are for some of these projects in the future?
I was just in Washington. I happened this year to be the chair of the Fermilab Users Executive Committee. And every year we organize a delegation to Washington to meet with Congress and to meet with funding agency people. And I heard firsthand the discouraging statement that $2 billion is too much for particle physics. And I said, but look, Fermilab was built in 1968 for $200 million. And if you wanted to duplicate that now, it would cost nearly $3 billion. And my friend Jerry Glacy at OSTP said, yeah, you couldn't build Fermilab anymore. Those times are past. So LBNE is the next big neutrino experiment in the U.S. Because theta 1-3 is large, it gets a real shot in the arm. It has a shot at discovering leptonic CB violation. And yet, DOE just turned down the Fermilab proposal because they said it looked like it was going to cost $2 billion. So Fermilab has to go back to the drawing board and figure out how to break it into pieces that each cost only $1 billion. When you do that, the whole project becomes more expensive. It's stretched out, there's duplication of effort, etc. But the way Congress is operating, they don't mind approving a series of billion-dollar projects, but $2 billion is a barrier that we can't break through, at least not for fundamental research. I can hope that maybe someday that mindset will change, but at the moment that's what we're stuck with. So this scheme envisions that you build a muon collider in pieces that are each about $1 billion. And the other thing about $1 billion is that it's a number that hasn't been increasing for inflation. It was $1 billion 10 years ago, and it's still $1 billion. So that's bad, right? That means that in the U.S., people who want to do these kinds of fundamental research investigations have to live on a shrinking budget in real dollars. And I hope at some point the people in Washington start to realize that you can't just leave all the fundamental research to be done by the Japanese and the Chinese and the Europeans if you want to have a healthy economy here.
I haven't read it yet, but there was apparently some very pessimistic article by Stephen Greenberg in the recent New York Review of Books about funding for large scientific projects.
Well, look at the Higgs, right? Weinberg was right there at the cutting edge when the Standard Model was being formulated in the 60s.
The Texas.
Sure. Apparently they offered him an enormous amount of money. So they wrote this beautiful theory and they got the Nobel Prize in the 70s. And yet the Higgs is a prediction that was made back then that's taking 50 years to test.
And the cost for that is far more than $2 billion.
Sure. Well, the LHC plus the experiments is $10 billion all by itself.
It's not operating.
But Europe is different.
Not operating, even.
Which?
That wasn't the operating cost.
That's also true. That's right. Europe is different. Because of the situation after World War II, the leading European countries all realized that they needed to cooperate on fundamental science. And so they all signed treaties that say that every year they're going to give CERN X number of euros. So CERN can count on a stable funding and can plan a $10 billion project, and we can.
Okay. Well, let's wrap it up and thank our speaker again. Any student wants to talk to Professor Kaplan?